This is Angle of View. Today is June 2nd, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Our director profile series continues this week with Sofia Coppola, one of the great second-generation directors working today, and one of the hardest to get a handle on, because her interest is in exploring the surfaces of things rather than in trying to get under them. And I still don't know why it is that sometimes this works in her favor and sometimes it doesn't. Her biggest champions celebrate her work as subtle and uncoercive, saying that its outer emptiness is a deft strategy for revealing a character's inner emptiness, while her detractors say things like this thing said by the critic Theo Panagides in his review of Priscilla, quote, "Coppola comes off as a sophisticated person with no firm ideas about anything, making films which can equally be read as ethereal and poignant, or critical and sharply feminist, and happy to trade on the ambiguity." Ouch, right? As much as I'd love to work up my own essay on the subject, to sort out my own thoughts, I'm afraid I can't do that for you today, so I'm just going to read my reviews of her 8 feature films, across which you will hear me pinging between precisely these poles of positive and negative sentiment. I'm going to read them in chronological order, and so I must apologize in advance for the anticlimax that the episode will come to. Coppola's most recent movie, Priscilla, is easily my least favorite, and I dismissed it rather cheekily. For what it's worth, I do feel I ought to watch it again because it has a lot in common with Marie Antoinette, which I recently rewatched and liked a great deal more than I had the first time, but anyway, here we go. The Virgin Suicides, 2000, from the novel by Jeffrey Eugenides. Review date, November 6th, 2024. Probably fourth viewing. Men dream of when they were boys, and when they were boys, they dreamed of girls. Coppola found and tenderly cracked the heart of the Eugenides novel, which is about how the things that evoke the strongest feelings in us are always the things we least understand, that those things take center stage in our dreams, and that the dreams then write our lives. Everything in the movie, as in the book, is swathed in love, sadness, and incomprehension. Everything in it slips through every set of fingers. Besides Coppola's beautifully assured hand with pen, performers, and camera, which gathers the craft into a dream of the 70s, two other contributions merit special mention. Kirsten Dunst, who is amazing as the vaporous Lux, a dream of a girl, one of the few performances as a vanishing, ethereal character that the actor makes unforgettable by that vanishing, by her perfect absence, and the score by Air, which is one of the greatest tonal matches for a movie ever achieved by music. Lost in Translation, 2003. Review date, May 11th, 2026. Second viewing. The Liminal Relationship. Few movies have ever gotten so much mileage out of gentleness, but that's the ticket here. From how Coppola depicts the suspension of these two floating souls, to the incredible subtlety of both Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson's warmth, to how Lance Accord, the director of photography, brushes it all onto the frame like a watercolor. It's the optimal approach to a story so tentative. Even the needle drops feel like when a familiar song plays back in a dream. Marie Antoinette, 2006. Review date, May 21st, 2026. Second viewing. This failed to imprint on me when I first saw it in the theater. I'm now pretty sure the fault was in me. This time I felt my heart breaking pretty much throughout on two levels. First, for the fact that Marie never had a chance to form into a person, and second, for the fact that Sofia Coppola found a way to demonstrate compassion for her without absolving her of her participation in the oppression of her people. On the contrary, this does the most powerful thing that a film trapped in the oppressor's perspective can do. It suggests the psychological connection between her inner emptiness and her outer rapacity. She had a bottomless pit that she kept trying to fill up. And the people who suffered under her rule didn't even exist to her. This aspect of it has been discussed to death, but the anachronisms really are the masterstroke. The only way to get a contemporary audience to see Marie's conditions in full, to see her shallowness and her pressures and her lifestyle as locked in a feedback loop, was to punch holes in the barrier called historical perspective that would otherwise separate us from her. First and foremost, this means turning Marie and her retinue into modern teenage rich girls. And this is smart enough as a strategy. But when Ceremony by New Order plays over a beautiful sunrise, and all the characters for just a second become regular teenagers making memories like you once did, Coppola is pulling something really tender and plaintive out of the same trick bag. The production design and costumes are beyond impeccable. Shooting at Versailles itself is a pretty good start. It's got one of the best opening slash closing shot and song bookends in history. And Kirsten Dunst is just brilliant. That signature crooked smile of hers bent into a dozen different meanings. I don't know if this is how the film came about, but I can easily picture Coppola capturing this actress's ethereal farawayness in The Virgin Suicides and thinking, who does this remind me of? Footnote: Jason Schwartzman's performance was actually the one that grew on me the most on this viewing. Dunst's Marie is the floating space princess, but Schwartzman's Louis is a 10-year-old boy wandering the fairgrounds after being separated from his parents. Somewhere, 2010, review date May 19th, 2026, first and only viewing. The line between a movie about vacuity and a vacuous movie is a fine one indeed. This is far from terrible. It feels unquestionably like Hollywood, and thank God for the perspective of Cleo, the daughter. But among Sofia Coppola's many movies about people locked in soft prisons, this is the first one whose quiet stillness isn't hiding anything. It would not be the last. The Bling Ring, 2013, review date May 30th, 2026, first and only viewing. The entire reason this works, and I don't know enough about the real story to know whether this part is strictly true or not, is that all the celebrities targeted by these vain, glamorous, attractive young criminals are vain, glamorous, attractive young people who were famous for being famous. The desire to be adjacent to fame and suck its blood and define yourself accordingly is understandable enough, but a groupie or whatnot is someone who worships a star and wants proximity in hopes that the personality of the worshipped star will rub off on them. The specific desire that these characters express to be adjacent to vacuous fame, purely by connection to the possessions of the vacuously famous, in hopes that what will rub off is some of that fame and lucre which they can keep for themselves, is fascinatingly impure. A second-order parasitism discovered by the first generation that was born seeing the world in brand terms. The movie's verisimilitude is rather staggering. Besides the essential fact that they use real celebrities' names and homes, all the rest of it clicks too. I am older than these people, and not from this kind of money, but I grew up in LA and still know enough to be able to certify that what you see here is not exaggerated by very much, not even the mother who homeschools her daughters using The Secret as her textbook. Great performances, except from Gavin Rossdale, all tuned to one notch on the NOMI dial below less than zero, the book, which is exactly right. 400 times better than Spring Breakers. The Beguiled, 2017, from the novel by Thomas Cullinan. Review date May 18th, 2026, first and only viewing. There's something, some small thing, to be said for the idea of Sofia Coppola applying her still and breathy style to harsh, pulpy material like this. And if, like me, you saw this movie before reading the source novel or seeing the 1971 Don Siegel adaptation, you might initially be impressed, like I was, by the subtlety of the tension that Coppola draws out over the first two acts, and the way she then appears to rise to the difficult and ugly demands of the third. Compared to everything else she's ever done, these late scenes of action and terror engage a person at the level of a genre movie. They feel like they're down in the hot furnace, rather than musing on it from a safe distance, an affective distance that, frankly, has always seemed inseparable from this director's life of privilege, if you'll permit a splash of psychoanalysis. And they send a charge backwards through the setup scenes so that you reflect on them with greater discomfort. But when you acquaint yourself with the Siegel version, as I did the following day, I have still not read the book, you see just how much Coppola has left out, and how much richness these omissions have cheated you out of, on every level of enjoyment, high and low alike. She claims that her intention was to anchor the story more firmly in the POV of the women and girls, but this is recompense for a supposed shortcoming of Siegel's film that simply is not in evidence. I feel that the female characters in his version have far more complex and interesting desires, and that they are made more clearly known. The more accurate inference of Coppola's treatment of the story is that she has attempted to protect the women, and the effect of this is that she has narrowed and muted the story almost to death. Critically, there seems little distinction in her version between the ways in which Martha, Edwina, and Alicia, as she is here called, want McBurney, the captive soldier, all of them just seem basically lonely and isolated, and their desires are differentiated merely by their placements on the age and experience spectrum. Whereas in Siegel's version, presumably closer to the novel, can't confirm, we become intimately familiar with the very different things that sex means to these three very different people. Coppola said that she cut the character of Hallie, the black slave, because she didn't want to portray a black character, quote, that way for her core audience demographic of young girls, which is another way of saying that she was afraid to do it, even though Hallie's presence draws absolutely vital lines of connection within the story's theme and substantially intensifies the character dynamics. But I don't believe she has commented at all on leaving out Martha's incest backstory. Presumably she was icked out by it, which is fear again. And what a shame, given how important this piece is for Martha's motivations and for creating the even match of perversion between her and McBurney. Everything seems so much flimsier and more timid without it. Edwina doesn't have the same virginal desperation, presumably because Coppola wanted Kirsten Dunst's character to be self-possessed and felt it would be an insult to put her in the grips of a desire that would render her powerless. And as for Alicia, Coppola was also clearly so afraid of portraying a 17-year-old girl as a hussy, to use the word spit at her by Edwina in the Siegel version, that she made her guilty only of a girlish curiosity and a lie told in panic, rather than be willing to make her any kind of malefactor or even instigator. She even changed her name from Carol to Alicia, as if to justify the transformation. She's also not willing to bring Amy into the center of the pit because she's only 12, even though in the Siegel version, the first thing McBurney does upon meeting her is ask her her age and then kiss her on the lips. This is all fear, isn't it? Coppola won't let any of the scorching, damning stuff play out in this story because she's afraid of it all. And speaking of McBurney, he has been shortchanged the worst. Neither his wickedness nor his charm, the two sides of his sexual evil, are anywhere near view here. And it's not Colin Farrell's fault. He's doing a decent job forcing a pulse upon his scenes. But the character is made passive and gentle, denied dignity or agency even of the perverse kind that was given by Siegel to Clint Eastwood's portrayal. Between the two actors, Eastwood is unquestionably the weaker, so this is a rather damning discovery. And lastly, though plot is and should be a smaller consideration in a torrid character drama, all these subtractions of Coppola's damage the plot badly, such that none of the events in the climactic chain have the momentum and the ruthless logic that pushes them into the terrible. She's even mostly subtracted the war. It delivers McBurney to the school, but never seems to pressurize anyone's decisions or feelings from that point forward. The shots of the girls keeping watch from the widow's walk seem purely aesthetic. McBurney's status as a Union soldier doesn't trouble these Virginia women much because their 21st century director knows that the Union was in the right. Sofia Coppola took a story of utterly twisted sexual power dynamics and took all the really bad stuff out. She even shies from the cruelty visited on the pet turtle. Why? If it's still going to get an R rating, why remove its fangs? On the Rocks, review date September 12th, 2023, first and only viewing. Coppola seemed to be consciously aiming for lighter, and accordingly this sort of eats like a meringue. Rashida Jones is at her strongest when she's reacting to being blathered at, which is how her character spends more than half the movie. Her face knows a whole vocabulary of politely annoyed expressions. When she speaks up, she loses something in herself, and it doesn't seem totally intentional. Bill Murray is always comfortable in the lovable pest routine, and his tactic for selling the serious moments, a pause lasting a few seconds too long, is almost bewilderingly effective. He's mostly coasted through these twilight years, and we forgive him, but here he really sinks into the scene a time or two. Coppola shoots with open-hearted grace and a bone-deep love of New York City that give a little extra luster, as do the choice of 35mm and the gentle hand that Philippe Le Sueur uses in painting the light on Same. But the story has rubber legs. It's a dopey suspicion and misunderstanding plot, which along with all of the little spots it contains, the stakeout, the mix-up in Mexico, the wife wanting the romantic gift for her birthday and getting the appliance instead, positively reeks of sitcom. Priscilla, 2023. Review date December 1st, 2023. First and only viewing. One of the most lifeless, lobotomized movies I've ever seen. Biopics are supposed to take an interest in their subjects. Coppola's Priscilla might as well have been inflatable. And while I don't doubt that this was meant as the movie's thesis statement, the unfortunate thing is that a thesis statement repeated 200 times doesn't make a thesis. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.